Hello and welcome to another edition of the Sussex Cricket Museum podcast. Today we're at Arundel in West Sussex. You may have listened to one of our recent podcasts from Eastbourne over in the east when we spoke to Les Lenham. And we're at the Arundel Castle cricket ground today. It's absolutely gorgeous. The green grass, the trees, we can see the flag on the castle in the distance. There is no cricket going on, but I've got two special guests with me today. And before I introduce them, I'll just read a quote from Wisden. And this says, "Adams stands ahead of all Sussex captains now, the princely Ranji and the autocratic C.B. Fry, the inspiring Arthur Gilligan and the elegant, sickly Dulip Singhi, the godly David Shepherd and the maverick Robin Marler, the imperious, glorious Ted Dexter, the towering Tony Greig and the preposterously enthusiastic John Barclay." So you may have guessed from that my two guests today are Chris Adams, the Sussex captain from the 2003 championship winning side. Morning, Chris.
Morning. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good.
Very
good,
well.
Good, good.
And further over, I've got the preposterously enthusiastic John Barclay, who, of course, was the captain of the 1981 side when Sussex so nearly won the championship. Good morning, John.
Keith, can I just tell you, Keith? Now, listen, I have never been described, I never realised I would ever be described as preposterously. And it's such a long word, I think I shall have to look it up, actually, later to see what it means. And preposterously enthusiastic. And as you know, enthusiasm, and for all that we all know this, enthusiasm covers up many, many inadequacies. And we use it in every guise possible. And when you're talking Sussex cricket over the years, there have been so many ups and downs, even for Chris, even within the captaincy era here of Chris, which we're going to chat about. There are all sorts of ups and downs. It's like the waves of the sea, the crests and the down in the depths. So it's fascinating. Fascinating chat, and thank you so much for having us.
That's great. Thank you very much for taking part in this podcast. And obviously, we're going to be talking, having done the 60th anniversary of the Gillette Cup, we're going to be talking about the 20th anniversary, and Chris had just said to me, it can't be 20 years ago, of the first championship win for Sussex, which I think was, again in Wisden, mentioned 164 years of hurt, which ended in that day in September 2003 at Hove. So I'm going to pass over to Johnny and Chris now to have a chat through this wonderful season that was in 2003.
Well, it's what a wonderful place to start. 20 years ago, Chris, I can hardly believe 20 years ago. And so that's 20 years ago for me. It's 40-odd years ago since we nearly, I love the idea of nearly, won the championship. So nothing, anything like as glamorous. But what I'd like to ask, starting you off, Chris, is just going back before the great success or successes of 2003 and then 6 and 7 and the one day successes. I mean, unknown to Sussex cricket before. But I don't think it all started like that. And I think our listeners would love to hear, in the first place, how you came from Derbyshire in the Midlands to Sussex back in the late 90s.
Well, let me just take my memory back, Johnny. Firstly, thank you to you and your team for nearly getting there, but not quite getting there, because I think if you had got there, I can't be certain, but it may have meant that I didn't come and play for Sussex, because I still remember meeting a chap called Tony Pygott for the very first time outside of a playing environment. Of course, he's a wonderful medium fast bowler. That's probably the best way to describe him, who I played against for many years. He'd become CEO, taken over as CEO at Sussex. And he was the one who sat in front of me back in a long time ago, 1997, in the winter of 1997 now, and there was a glint in his eye, and he made me feel alive for the first time for a few years. And it was this notion of creating a legacy, come to Sussex, create a legacy, do something that nobody has ever done before, and that is lift the county championship. So had you done it, he wouldn't have been able to sit in front of me with that glint in his eye and sell me that line. But that I do remember. And those first, that first year of 1998 was a fantastic year for me. It was the first time I captained a county team, a county side. So I was learning on the job. I was bringing all the elements of what I thought was the right way to go about leading to the table, making loads of mistakes along the way as well, of course, as we do. It's part of learning. I remember that wonderful first championship game that I captained at Hove against Lancashire. And I managed to talk John Crawley, the Lancashire captain, into setting us very modest, I think it was about somewhere between 220, 250, over 75 overs on the last day. Because they felt that, you know, they had comfortably enough firepower to bowl us out. And I convinced him they did. And we won it. We won that game. It was fantastic. Robin Martin Jenkins, who was a boy at the time, played the most wonderful innings in that game. But it was really, that was the mindset change for me for that year was, here was a club that had unfortunately gotten used to not winning. And by virtue of that, its mindset was at trying not to lose.
Yes.
So the easy one for me straight away was to try and get rid of that notion of trying not to lose, but actually looking at how we might win. And that's how I remember the first 2 years, is really trying to create this mindset of, look, what do we need to do to win a game of cricket, and then apply everything around that. It wasn't that easy, of course. And as time will yield in the year 2000, it was our annus horribilis, and we finished bottom of everything. And I was very fortunate to keep the job.
But it's interesting, Chris, very interesting, Chris, what you say, this concept in life of success and failure, because I think what you're saying is that it's out of losing from time to time, or one might call it failure, that one strengthens and improves as a team, as a unit, and within one's personal play. But you also did it with assistants. So you teamed up first with Tony Pigott, and also you teamed up with a new head coach in Peter Moores, who had been playing as a wicketkeeper batsman for Sussex, then took on the role of head coach, I think, with you. I think he was your first. So the teamwork element with Peter, with Tony Pigott, with some success, but also you mentioned the year 2000, considerable setback. Tell us a little bit about how those setbacks really framed the situation forward into the 2000s, when, of course, you was very successful.
I still remember Tony Pigott being asked what was the secret to success, and he said there's no secret. It's about getting the right people in the right positions doing the right jobs. And I think if I remember back to when I'm asked about how did it all come to fruition, we had some wonderful people in the right positions at the time. Yeah. And of course, like, nothing stays forever. Things change, and, you know, Tony left after a few years, but other people came in and moved it on. Peter Moores was an emerging coach who had his own challenges and his battles with David Gilbert in the early days.
Yes.
So it was, you know, it wasn't straight sailing from day one, but we were all learning on the job. And fortunately, Peter and I gelled from day one. I remember the day I signed, and we got told by Robin Marler, and Don Tranmar was the chairman-elect, and he was running committee meetings then, and he said, go and bond, go and get together, go and talk about, you know, how you're going to dominate world cricket. And of course, we went off, and we didn't stop talking for it seemed like hours, until there was a knock on the door to say, you're already 15 minutes late for the committee meeting that you... The first one, Johnny, the first one. I remember walking in and getting my first bollocking from Don Trangmar. We sat down, but, you know, all in jest. And I suppose, in essence, the first 3 years, I always talk about the first 3 years, were trial and error. And unfortunately,
yes,
error sort of came to the front of house in the year 2000. But we walked into another committee meeting at the end of that season, and we both, I walked into that meeting, you were there, you were present, and I fully expected Peter to lose his job.
Really?
And I would, you know, I had a contract to play at the club, but I thought I'd be losing the captaincy. And there was opinions were sought round the table. Everyone gave their opinion. It wasn't looking great, I have to admit. I do remember you throwing preposterously enthusiastic comments towards the end of the meeting, which thankfully, it is quite difficult to say that, isn't it? which thankfully,
a word I wasn't expecting.
Which thankfully found their way. I always remember where you sit as well, because now I'm on the committee there. I try and sort of sit in a similar place, but across the table towards Don Trangmar. And I remember Don suddenly shutting his fantastic big book he used to bring into these meetings, shut it, and it made a big sound. And he said, right. He said, if anybody's going to lose their positions today, it will be all of us around this table, because we were the ones that put you two in position without giving you any clear identity of what it is we want you to achieve. So you two, I won't say what he said, but off you go. And you're going to come back in 6 to 8 weeks, and you're going to present what the next 3 years looks like and how you're going to do it. And with that, we were out the door, joining the rest of the team. We were out on their end of season night out, and they were, I think, as surprised as us when we told them that we hadn't lost our jobs and that we lived to fight another day.
Oh, it's so interesting, isn't it? You go back, but as things emerged from that year of 2000 onwards, and my memory is a little bit scanty on this, but I don't remember it so well. But gradually, through trial and error, and we all use a lot of trial and error in our lives, and it's usually error that creates the success in the end. That's what forms the success. But through that, you mentioned people. Gradually, you began to frame around you or form around you the right sort of people with the varied skills that had just half a chance of success. Now, how did that emerge?
So, through a shared view with Peter, really, in terms of how we wanted it to look, and what type of player we needed to make it happen, really. So it was the first time in my cricketing professional career that I'd met somebody who shared the same views, that ability alone wasn't enough, that attitude needed to have a shared level, really, and that, you know, that whilst there were lots of fantastically talented cricketers around, that at that era perhaps they didn't always have the right attitude. So we set out on this journey of either retaining or signing players and developing players with that model, really, that they had to work hard. We used analysis for the first time. Yeah. We were identifying what the very best were doing, which at the time was Leicestershire and Surrey. And we said to ourselves, right, we don't necessarily have the talent depth that they do, but we can do the same things that they do, but by virtue of working twice as hard as they would work, for example. And we set off on that journey. Into 2001, when we did win the second 11 championship, it was one off
second division,
the Division Two Championship. It was one off the back of graft, really. I remember most of our wins were won about 30 minutes after tea on day four, and I remember looking at this battery of seam bowlers, this wonderful battery of seam bowlers in Jason Lurie, James Kirtley, Mark Robinson was coming to the end, Robin Martin Jenkins, emerging talent. I remember looking at them, it's almost weekly on day four, thinking, these poor chaps, they had nothing left because they'd had to bowl their absolute hearts out as well as their physical entities out to win us a game of cricket. And, you know, the batters had the easy task because we were, you know, inevitably playing on some good pitches around that time. And I felt that was the beginnings of the concept in my mind. I felt that we needed something. We needed a bit more firepower, let's put it that way.
Some wonderful players did emerge. And I'm so interested as to where luck and skill meet together. So there's an element of good fortune that, for example, I imagine, the skills of James Kirtley emerging as a young player, fast bowler, and Jason Lurie appearing out of the blue and could actually swing the ball to come together with Robin. And then, I don't know whether it was a miracle or a wonderful, I don't know what happened, and how Mushtaq appeared in the midst of this drama to just bring together something that was both brilliantly skillful and very smiling and joyful as well. It was a joy. How much luck and how much skill, Chris, do you think emerged from all of that?
Well, you've set that up beautifully, Johnny, because you know exactly how Mushtaq arrived, as you were very much a pivotal part of it. Let's just tie off that seam attack first and foremost, because every captain, I always say this, a good captain is only a good captain because he has good players. There have been many a bad captain who's had good players, and hence the reason for teams not winning very often. But you need the combination of all that together. James Kirtley, run through brick walls, never complain, highly skillful, unbelievable athlete, everything that you would attach to the modern day cricketer. You know, put great fuel in his body, and just would bowl all day if you needed him to, any end, into the wind, uphill, downhill, wherever. An absolute diamond. For me also, vice captain, who was so trusted and didn't always agree with me, which I felt was healthy, but to the face of the team, they would never know that. He would always support me and back me up. Absolute brilliant. Jason Lurie, one of the most talented swing bowlers, I think is probably a fair way to describe him, that the game has ever seen. And we'll talk probably later about how he extended his career, because Jason with a new ball was dynamite. But actually, when the shine went away and the ball stopped swinging, his confidence would drop. So we had to manage him very carefully. Robin Martin Jenkins, probably, when people are asked, you know, great players who never played international cricket, I think Robin, if Robin was in this era now, with all that is attached to this era, I think he would be, he's a very similar cricketer to Chris Wokes. You know, he was a very similar cricketer to Chris Wokes. Taller in stature, obviously, but this beautiful control with line and length, get the ball moving both ways. He bowled, we didn't know it then, Johnny, but he was bowling wobble seam back then when even he didn't know he was bowling wobble seam. So it was just ahead of his time. And whilst we'd brought into the team Mark Davis, you know, tough, enigmatic South African, great leader. He'd had captaincy experience, real nugget with the bat, and great fielder, great attitude. As an off spinner, if we were going to go on and win things, then Mark would always be the second spinner in the team for me. You know, with him as the first front spinner, as I say, we often had to win our games in the very last hour of a 4-day game. So it was this need to give this fabulous bowling unit something that would take the pressure off them a little bit, and that's where Mushtaq came in. I remember we'd had these discussions, Peter and I. We talked about the type of bowler we wanted, who was the problem, because they, you know, like hen's teeth, and we remember Mushtaq playing for Surrey, a couple of games he filled in for Sacklane, and one of them was against us at Hove, and he bowled, and I was privileged enough to be out there to play against him and bat against him, and he bowled beautifully, and he didn't take a wicket. And to me, it's an absolute mystery. But it, sometimes some things are meant to be. So we presented this wonderful case to the committee, of which you were part of, towards the end of that season. And we came up with this cunning plan, because getting money out of the Sussex committee wasn't always easy. But we'd had this wonderful gift from Spen Karma, which hadn't arrived because of probate and all that, but we knew that it was there. So I suppose at the back of Peter and I's mind was that, you know, there was the budget, obviously, which we had spent, but obviously, you know, was there an opportunity to squeeze the budget a little bit on this occasion? And we came up with a dynamite idea, which was we would present the desire to sign Stuart McGill, who was coming in at that time at a pricely £100,000 a year contract, which we knew straight away that would get rejected. But we had up our sleeve this secondary option of Mushtaq, who was coming in at, you know, more than half less than that, that we might have a chance of getting Mushtaq. So Peter did a brilliant job, presented, and I remember, bless him, John Snow straight away, absolutely up in arms, not £100,000, not a chance, you know, Which, so John, again, unbeknown to him, played his part. You know, it's probably the best innings he ever played. And I remember Don Tranmere saying, well, if not McGill, what else is out there? And then again, Peter delivered the Mushtaq, and there was a few murmurings and grumblings, and, well, you know, he didn't get a wicket against us. But he had gone to Leicestershire the week later and took 8 wickets. So we had that in the back. And then it went round the table as often, and there was some for, some against. And then it came to the great man on my right here, Johnny, who played this beautiful shot through the covers by suggesting what would, you know, if Spen was looking down on this meeting now, what would he be saying? Well, he'd be saying, well, what a wonderful way to spend this money. A little bit of this money, just a tiny, tiny little bit of this money, you know, that it might just make the difference. And with that, the book was shut again, and off you go, sign this guy, and the rest is history.
It's a lovely story, and I think it's pretty well true, oddly enough. But I'll tell you how it also came about, if I can add my little part to it. When I was captain way back, so we're way, way back in the olden days now, 80, 81, Spen Karma, who many will remember listening to this, Spen was president then of Sussex County Cricket Club, as it was then. And every year, Spen, who was a great friend, a lovely man, every year Spen would sit in front of all the staff and the players in April and say, more or less, I'm paraphrasing, this is our year. This is the year we're going to win the county championship. That's what I want to do, or want us to do, more than anything else in the whole world. And I never forgot it. And I remembered that. We want to win the county championship. So when it came to this slightly unusual meeting, I remembered that. And I also remembered one other thing, which was interesting. From right at the tail end of my career, just before I was about to call it a day, in the late 1980s, Imran Khan, who had already more or less called it a day with Sussex, said to me, he said, if there's one man you must get as your overseas player, he'll win you game after game, it's Abdul Qadir from Pakistan. And Abdul ran in quite fast. He was quite small, actually, Abdul Qadir. And he ran in, and he bamboozled everybody. And nobody could really read him. And he was a sort of genius. And can you imagine county cricketers around the circuit, even good ones, honestly, truly, you'd never seen that sort of thing, being able to cope with it. And if I'm truly honest, probably Abdul Qadir possibly was an even more stronger and more powerful leg spin, googly, top spin bowler than Mushtaq, although Mushtaq was very good. But they were slightly similar, because Mushy came in and there was a bit of flight and there was a bit of guile, and he'd give away one or two runs, but he got people out. And that, as it turned out. But Chris, this is where I come on across skill and luck. We didn't know this was going to work.
No.
I mean, you didn't know it was going to work.
It's funny you mentioned pace, because I remember Mushtaq's first game. I want to say it was a game at Lords against a collective side from the counties, that where the champion county would play best of the rest, all that sort of stuff. Yeah. And I remember Mushtaq coming on and bowling, and I was stood at slip and immediately having this sense of not doom, but something wasn't right. And he, as you describe it, he was throwing the ball up so high and giving it so much air. And of course at Lords, which, you know, it's not renowned for its spin at Lords, and he was getting thumped all over. And I was thinking, have we made an error here? And I remember sitting down with him after the game and talking to him about how he bowls and the characteristics of his bowling. And it dawned on me, and it was out of his mouth really, that he'd been encouraged to bowl like that by his seam bowling unit. So Wasim Akram, Waqar Yunus, who were terrifyingly quick and wonderful bowlers, would use Mushtaq in a test match as a break, really, and would say to him, come on, you can bowl 10 overs. We don't mind if you go for 6 and over, but if you can take 2, 3 or 4 wickets by, you know, buying a wicket, really, for want of a better phrase, then that helped them more than anything, and they would come on and clean up and etc. So I then embarked with other people in the team. Matt Pryor was really pivotal to that, because at the time, at the start of the season, he had the gloves. Ambrose would finish, but he would, and I would become, and Tony Cotty, who would often do slip, we had to encourage Mushtaq to bowl flatter and quicker on English wickets. And the part of the reason for that is because we couldn't afford for him to go at 6 and over. Sure. We needed him to go at 2.5, 3 and over, and bowl a lot more overs to give Kirtley, Lurie and Martin Jenkins the time they needed to be fresh all the time. And it took about three games. And then I remember him bowling at Hove. I can't remember who it was against, sadly, but I remember him bowling, and suddenly it felt right. He was running in like Kadir, and he was fizzing it. I think we'd given him the ball down the hill, and he was fizzing it, and it was it was a masterclass watching from slip or bat pad on the offside, or he bowled whoever it was out single-handedly, and that was it. And that was all the encouragement he needed to know that this is how he had to bowl in England. The thing is, for his 5 seasons here, Johnny, or 6, every first game that he played, he came back and he started throwing up the hand grenades. And I had to sit him down and say, Mushy, this is not how it works. You remember? And he went, I remember. And off we would go again.
This is a fascinating talk on strategy. I hope all our listeners and our younger listeners, older listeners, everyone, well, this is all tactics. But I'm just suggesting there was a bit more to Mushtaq than just bowling, wasn't there?
Oh, goodness me. I mean, there are many words that people use in around teams for the type of I mean, Mushy was unique, because he was not just an incredibly skilled, talented cricketer. Arguably, his greatest element that he brought to the team was himself and his ability to make everyone else feel so positive. And that his great phrase was borrowed from The Lion King, which was Hakuna Matata, which means no worries. And he would always use that in and around any team talk, and in his own inimitable style of way. And very early on, we recognised that we lucked out, as Johnny says. Sometimes you do get lucky. I've known a lot of fantastic overseas talents that were, let's face it, hard work to integrate into a team, and would often have an effect on others in the team in a negative way. But Mushtaq was the opposite, and was very smart and very clever with it. And I still keep my ear very closely to the ground, and Mushtaq is still out there coaching around the world. And I think the best way of describing Mushtaq is as a coach now is that he doesn't coach the cricketer, he coaches the person. I think that's such a great attribute to have.
Do you think that Mushtaq's spirituality, his Islamic faith, also had a bit of a spin-off on the nature of the team, indirectly, without them obviously being of Muslim faith, but his spirituality, was that significant?
Life is an education, isn't it? And for teams, I mean, no more example than in the modern day that we live in, where we're constantly being educated on elements of life. And Mushtaq brought, well, I suppose one of the hardest things when you're being educated is wanting to be educated, or are you having something thrust on you? Yeah. And Mushtaq brought his religion and his beliefs into that environment, and in his own style, without us realizing, he was educating us. And there was at no stage did I can't speak for others, but I felt that it was being forced on us, and in fact we were growing as a team because of it, and growing as human beings as well. We wouldn't know then, but we will, as you look back, you get a bit older and wiser, you can see how that developed, and as a dressing room, we grew because of his beliefs.
Oh, isn't that so interesting? And I think it's a fascinating experience of education as well as cricket. Now, changing the subject a tiny bit, we've talked a lot about the bowlers. And, of course, bowlers are key. And even in my good luck, as I had way back in the early 80s, we had some bowlers, thank goodness. But batting is also an absolutely key element. And within your armoury, you mentioned a moment ago good pitches. I'm sure some were good pitches, some less so. But you had some outstanding batsmen, Murray Goodwin, Matt Prior, Tony Cottee, and indeed yourself. So I'd love to hear about the batting lineup and the approach to batting. And I'd love to hear, we'd love to hear, the listeners would love to hear, about your contribution as a key player as well as leading the side.
Ooh, yes.
It's a big one.
It's a big one. Well, we certainly, I suppose my own journey, I remember arriving at Sussex and I was still on a mission to play for England, play for my country.
Which you did.
Which I did. Mm. And I was... So I guess what I would say is at that stage, my lens was very much looking through myself and my ambitions and my needs and my desires, as well as trying to understand what being a captain was all about and learning how to create an environment and be... a vocal and a tactical point for to get the best out of others as well, rather than just myself. And there was no doubt, at the first couple of years, I was the leading batsman in the team. I knew that. I had to accept that responsibility, which I wanted at the time. And then, of course, as the team developed, it was a role which I had to relinquish, you know. Did I want to? No. But actually, as I understand how to become a better captain, it was something which I looked for and welcomed, and for other players to grow and become centre stage, if you like. And you mentioned some wonderful players. I mean, we'll talk about Murray Goodwin. What a batsman, and what a character as well. Matt Prior, who came through the ranks, through Bryant College, through the pathway system, through the team, and was the focus of a lot of attention. Yeah. Mike Yardie as well. And again, Tony Cottee, who I always used to call the glue in the team, because Tony was the one that would just would say to me, "Can I have a quick word?" And he'd take me outside or to a corner in a restaurant or a hotel bar or something like that, and in a wonderfully lovely way would tell me where I'd been going wrong, and he knew that If he challenged me openly, it would become a negative entity. But by having a conversation with me quietly, he had the ear of the dressing room, you know, and he was the glue that held us together, as well as being a fine batsman and tough, as tough a batsman as you'll come across. The one person you haven't mentioned is one of my all-time favourites, and somebody who first on the team sheet always for me, because he opened the batting, was Richard Montgomery, who the most wonderful character, wonderful guy, and on his day, devastatingly good batsman, Devastatingly good batsman. Jonathan Trott-esque, you know, light the leg side. Didn't often see a cover drive or a square cut, but, you know, a clip off the legs, often from a ball delivered a foot and a half outside off stump, was Monty's style, and a very, very good puller and hooker of the ball. So, there was a jostling of positions. Yes. We never quite settled on an order. Some would move around. In the early days, we had Michael Bevan in there as the overseas player. What a wonderful batsman he was. But the I suppose, of all of that collection of players, I eventually ceded number one status as the batter to Murray, and who would argue? Interesting character. And I think the thing about all great teams is that they are often a collection of different character and characteristics within personality. And I know that Peter often had a lot of challenges with Murray, you know, because Murray did things differently and he did things in his own way, in his own style, but he had amazing belief in his own ability. And the one thing that perhaps people won't ever remember Murray for is his obvious, visible work rate. As we were all out in the nets batting, Murray would often be sat up on the balcony, just relaxing, getting ready for the game. But I can tell you the number of Sunday mornings I used to come in after a game just to collect a few things and perhaps have some treatment with the physio. And there he would be in the indoor school. He loved the bowling machine, Murray, and he would be in there, sweating away, working away at his game, and putting the time into his skills that we all know are needed. You need to do that, but sometimes the very best and most talented players in the world don't often like to show off that they work hard like the rest. And Ken Peterson is a player I coached who exactly does that. Yes. You know, practices secretly, you know. Yes. And Murray was a secret practicer and a secret trainer. He'd go in the gym and train when people thought he was perhaps this happy-go-lucky, skillful, talented cricketer.
I think you've touched upon such an interesting thing within teamwork, and this accounts for all teams, not just cricket teams, is that you have a group of people, slightly different ages, although they're all youngish, who have come from often very different backgrounds, nationalities, upbringing, whatever it might be. And you as captain have to put it all together. So, for example, I remember taking two of your players you've mentioned. As under-16s, Matt Prior and Mike Yardy, and actually Chris Nash as well, who may have emerged towards the end.
A little bit later. Yeah.
Chris Nash, they all came along to the nets here because there wasn't a cricket school then at Hove. And they could not, as 16-year-olds, have been more different as players with ambition, different temperaments, some more fiery than others, some more gentle, so completely different. So you had that within your side, and you've mentioned it a little bit, talking about Murray Goodwin and talking about and Richard Montgomery, who I expect was fairly straightforward in a way. I don't know. I mean, who knows? But the chemistry within teamwork, when your captain in cricket, and remember, for all the listeners, remember, the captain in cricket is out there with the team, running the show, and also having to play a significant part. The manager of a football team doesn't do that. Not many managers or chief executives really do that. But so cricket is a bit different. So when you got into the leadership, into the captaincy, with a bit of success, and a bit of one-day success, I'd quite like to hear about that too. having to cope daily with these temperaments. We don't want to hear about rows and ructions, but I know they happen. I'm not naive. I've played this lark. But it's not easy, and you've had to deal with that. And it's probably the best education you've ever had in terms of management, leadership, etc.
It's a fascinating point, and it's when you look back on a period of success that the club and the team had, it's never down to one moment. There's always key moments through that period, and there was a key moment when Peter and I were so close that became quite intimidating to the team, because we were so in line with each other that there was nowhere to go once we'd said this is how it's going to be. Because if we were both on the same page all the time, yet there were people in the team that felt differently, then to create an environment where the players couldn't have a voice was one of the reasons we perhaps had the tough challenges of the year 2000. So, and actually, Matt Pryor is a key person in the evolution of that team, because I remember addressing the team. I don't remember the particular game that we were playing and who we were playing against, but there was an opportunity to set a declaration.
Yeah.
And I remember setting the scene. I'd spoken to Peter. I delivered in the dressing room what we're thinking. And I said, look, do you all agree with that? And this is the point where silence, and you get these eyes looking back at you and nobody would say anything. And I sort of said, whereas in the past I'd gone away and we'd done all right, what we felt was right, I said, right, I'm going to say this again. There is 11 of us in here and 11 of us need to go out there and make this happen. Therefore, all 11 of us need to be confident that this is the right way to go. And I'm requesting you, if any of you have got a different opinion or fit a point, then I want you to make it. If it's different to ours, it won't be viewed as a negative. In fact, it'll be viewed as a positive. And with that, Matt Pryor shot up and said, well, I think we should be setting this. And it was a lower target.
Oh, right.
And I was like, he said, I think that they'll never go for that. The game will, it'll just become a draw. Okay, fine. With that, I put Matt on this pedestal because he was only young at the time. And this is brilliant. This is exactly what we need. And does everybody agree with that? And one or two sort of, because the conversations had been going on in the changing room when Peter and I were in there, and one or two were saying, well, yeah, we think that's probably the right way to go. Da, da, da. So I went, even though deep down in my heart, I'm thinking, this is crazy. I've got to go with this. So I went, I said, right, brilliant, Matt, fantastic. This could be one of the biggest days in our evolution. You know, a 22-year-old standing up and challenging, you know, the tactical elements of what the coach and the captain think. And, you know, I think this is a big day for us. We're going to go with you like that. Yeah. So that was it. Off we went out and we, oh, my days. We let's just say we didn't lose the game. But we very nearly did. The element of that risk was far greater, because it now gave the dressing room the confidence to speak up. And that for me was a huge, huge part of our getting to the next level, with that ability to people to have open conversations without fear of recrimination. And that they had a voice, and we wanted to hear their voice, and we were a collective, not just a headstrong captain and a headstrong coach.
That's so interesting. I think that's lovely. Keith, you've got this wonderful book open in front of you. I see you thumbing through the pages of The Longest Journey. The Longest Journey.
The
wonderful story of The Long Journey, which ended up in triumph and jubilation. Have you found something in there that you'd like to...
I'm still looking for something, John, that related, I think, possibly to the game that Chris was talking about, the draw.
Don't worry.
As we're sat here at Arundel, can I just recreate probably the most important game in the history of the club? was here at Randall, which, yeah. by the way, ranks number two in my all-time favourite grounds, just behind Lord's, and only just ahead of Hove. So for those,
well,
I hope,
an honour.
Yeah, well, I had such a good time here. It was.
Tell us about that game.
Right, okay, 2002.
Yep.
Towards the back end of the 2002 season, and we've entered Division One for the first time, yep. and it's a struggle. It's a real struggle. No mushtack, and our seam bowlers are under more physical pressure than they've yep. ever been. So much so that we've recalled the legend that is Mark Robinson, who'd gone off to become Setting 11 coach and start his coaching career.
Yes.
And we played him here against Yorkshire. Now, Yorkshire, at the time, struggling along with us in Division 1 and below us by only a few points. And the game goes the whole 4 days. I remember, Darren Lehman playing, exceptionally well. And,
was that
and
when he made 200?
No, maybe later.
Sorry,
it came down to, you start these games and bless him, Mark Robinson bowled a 12 over spell in the first innings here,
yeah.
and I don't think he bowled again for about 4 years. He came in the next day. He was he couldn't move effectively, and that was him done really for the rest of the game. I knew he wouldn't get any overs out of him in the second game. I think I actually had to bowl a few myself, but. Fast forward to the last hour of the game. I think it was an hour and 15 minutes to go. And we are 9 down. And looking at a loss. And we would slip below Yorkshire in yeah. the table. And into one of the relegation places. And Mark Robinson hobbles out to the middle to bat with Matt Prior. And between them, they play a heroic partnership. And get through the hour and 15 minutes, which means we get, I think at the time, 3 points for the draw. And we stayed up by 1 point that year. So without the contribution of Mark Robinson in that last hour and 15 minutes, we would have been relegated, which meant that in 2003, we wouldn't have been competing for the championship. So I always say one of the most important, pivotal, key games of that 2003 championship was the year before when we played Yorkshire here at Arundel.
I think that's so interesting. And this was about sort of August, early
mid-August. Yeah, I think so, yes.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, I remember it.
Yeah.
I remember, Robbo, Mark Robinson, was not noted for his expertise with the bat, was he? But he was determined. Would you say that? Is that fair?
Preposterously determined. I think is the right phrase.
And I forgot that Matt was the other end. And it was a long time. I was here.
Hour and 15 minutes.
It was a long time.
The game was dead. It was that. I mean, Mark, bless him, Robbo, if he lasted a few balls, we were often delighted. No, that's unfair. He could hold up an end. There's no doubt about
that. He would definitely say it was unfair. But
yeah.
but I think it's so interesting. I think Keith, what's so interesting for everyone listening to this is there are certain similarities of teamwork which are similar throughout the world. And one of the key things, and I can relate to very clearly, and it was lucky, is that I was lucky in 1980, 81, 82, for about 3 or 4 years, although we weren't ultimately anywhere near as successful as those years in the early 2000s. But I was lucky is that we had some players, some good players, some particularly good bowlers. I don't think we in 81, 80 were quite as strong with the bat. We weren't bad, but I don't think we were quite as consistent with the bat. But we had some good bowlers. And we always used to say, that with the greatest respect to Glamorgan, and this is a bit unfair, it was Glamorgan then, not Glamorgan now, if Mike Brearley had been captain of Glamorgan, we think he'd have struggled a bit. because you do need some people who can bat and bowl. Above all, and every team needs that first and foremost. Mm. And then there's the teamwork and the strategy and working together with the different temperaments. Mm. And I think you've explained that so clearly. It's been a joy.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I'm often told by people who feel a certain way that we only won the championship because we had Mushtaq. Well, my answer to that is that Mushtaq, I think, had four or five seasons down at Somerset, and they're still waiting to win their championship, aren't they? So the yes. and by virtue of the answer to that conundrum is you're at 100% right. We not only had good players, Johnny, we had great people.
Yes.
And those great people, and you know, and the captain is only as good as the people around. And those great people were the ones that got the best out of Mushtaq. They made him feel like Sussex was his family, if that makes sense, and not just his team, his family, and that he would do anything for his family, and that's a different level.
That's lovely, isn't it? And I'm sure that there are many listeners to this chat. I'm sure would love to hear, because it is of interest. So post cricket, there's a lot of life. And people must realise this, after professional cricket. Really good professional cricketers may play to the age of 35, 36, 37, one or two even more on some of it. But there's a lot of life, huge amount of life afterwards. I'm sure everyone would love to hear about your work and life at Seaford College.
Ah, Seaford College, just down the road. do you know what? I was, when you contemplate life after cricket, you look at, right, what are the options here? There are obviously media roles, there are coaching roles, and one of the things I wrote down was independent school, and I said, well, what, that will be the last 10 years of my working career. That's when I'll go into that sector and start to slow down a little bit. Well, and Seaford came along out of the blue, really, through a wonderful friendship through my discovery of the game of tennis. I'd met this lady who was a very good tennis player, and she became my mixed doubles partner. Yeah. And her children had gone to Hurst College, and she said, "Oh, I was having dinner with a friend of ours, who's now the headmaster at Seaford, formerly the assistant or the deputy head at Hurst." And he said, "I've got to get you." I said I was playing tennis with you. He said, "I've got to get you down there to, you know, do some masterclass sessions." So within a short space of time, I'm driving. At this moment in time, I'd started working for Holland, so who have a very periodic program through the year. So you'll go away for 6 weeks and then you'll come home and have 8 weeks off. So I was into this place of working intensely for 6 weeks and then nothing for eight weeks. I've got time here, so I'll go and see John Green, the headmaster at Seaford College, and see what he's got in mind. And I remember driving through the gates. I'm never, you know, firstly, Seaford College, why it's not in Seaford, to me was a mystery. I now know, but there I am, driving through these wonderful gates and this drive which goes on forever and ever and ever to the mansion there. And through, and I met this fantastic lady who's now a very good friend, Angie, who is the PA to the headmaster. She was brilliant, sat me down, got me a cup of coffee, and then John arrives. In I go into the study. I mean, the headmaster's study, Johnny. Ooh, I tell you what, it's an intimidating place, let me tell you. And then 45 minutes later, having had this fantastic chat with, you know, an ex-sportsman himself, John played for Saracens rugby, and amongst others. And I'm driving back down the drive, scratching my head, thinking, I've just agreed to do the entire summer term with the cricket. He's a brilliant, he's very, very good, John, at getting you to do things, basically. Yeah. So I did it with a bit of a, well, I'll only be here for a few weeks, and 6 years on, here I am. And it's been, and people ask me, do you enjoy it? And my answer to that is, I love it. Yeah. I love it. There is,
and
yeah,
you do more than just sport, is that right? You're an ambassador for the school as well, which is that right?
I say, John is very good at getting you to do things. So we had a change in director of sport, and I'd been around for a couple of years. So the old director of sport ran the sports charity dinner. The new guy came in, he you know, with a very big platform of plans and ideas. So John said, do you fancy taking on the sports dinner? And so I did, and then he pulled me in another day and said, I think we should have a golf day. Do you think it'd be a good idea? And I said, I think it's a great idea. And he said, good, you can organise it. You're going to go and run it. So, and then an alumni, and we have several sporting events through the year where we're interlock and engage with the alumni. So I'm very lucky. I have to say, I've tried a bit of all the other sports as well. So in the first couple of years, I was coaching a bit of netball with the girls, and then a bit of rugby, and eventually I've settled on a sport which to me I've started to love almost as much as cricket, and that is hockey. I absolutely love the hockey, and you know I'm taking my umpire badges and trying to just keep myself educated and developed and moving forward and keeping myself within the community there. So I really do love it. It's a really refreshing environment. I wouldn't say it's any less challenging than being in the professional world of cricket. You know, we've got almost 1,000 students at the school, and as we know, children between the ages of 6 and 18 are challenging. So you put 1,000 of them together, and then they'll give you the challenges. But there isn't the stigma of pressure that I see exists, and I experience myself in the professional game. That you know, this the need to win.
Talking of enthusiasm,
yes,
not preposterously, but I can't say the word, I'm afraid. So, but talk about enthusiasm, expertise, and children and youngsters. There is no one more enthusiastic and welcoming than your daughter Georgia within her work for women's cricket, the Vipers, and at the Brighton Aldridge Academy. You must be very thrilled about that, because I get a wonderful welcome every time I go there or here or wherever, and they're here this Saturday. The Vipers are playing.
They are. It's family day.
Tell us all.
The Vipers are here. Look, at this point, I have to go on record and say I'm incredibly proud of all three of my daughters, because because if I don't say that,
of course you must.
They'll be the first to tell me the two that don't get the accolade. So, and they are, you know, incredibly proud of all three of them. Georgia, being the eldest, has been not only a trailblazer in the family, but in women's cricket as well. Yeah, her journey has, you know, one day she'll be sat here talking us through it, and it will be fascinating to hear her version of how it all emerged.
Yes.
And she's already starting to find herself doing that, quite rightly so. She's projects herself brilliantly. Her cricket, I mean, she'll be 30 in October. Let's get that right. And she's at the top of her game. You know, she's just hung in there for so long. And the Brighton Aldridge Academy is a huge contributing factor in that, because when Georgia got the awful phone call, as you know, we've all at some stage had a phone call, and this one came from the England Academy coach to say that her 4 years in the England Academy was sadly coming to an end. With it was, she, you know, it's that moment where you're, well, I'm on my own here, what do I do, where do I go, how do I move forward from this point in time? And of course her only platform then was the Sussex women, the county cricket. So she had to sort of find a vehicle which kept her connected to the top end of the game.
Yes.
And that's where Bakker comes in. Mm. She got a job there as assistant director of cricket to Alexia Walker, who's a great friend of hers. And, of course, the facility is second to none. Mm. So she was able to not only begin a coaching career, young developing cricketers, but also she could use the facilities herself to keep her physical conditioning and also her skills to a level where she's at now. And then, of course, in the last 3 years, the women's game has just gone.
And she's captaining the Vipers? Sorry?
She's captain the Vipers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's with the Southern Brave.
Yeah.
In the 100 coming up. She's also just signed a contract to go out to Sydney in October for 4 months to play for the New South Wales Breakers, which is the equivalent of the county women's team here. And she's getting paid, Johnny, to do it. I can't believe it. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. I think, and watch this space, because I think women's lovely. Cricket, and I see this, I see this through our own development at the school with our girls' programme. Women's game is just flying, and there is no ceiling at the moment to how big it can become. And I just hope that the powers that be and the people that create the major opportunities at the top can see that and continue to give the women the platform that they've finally got, because I'm biased, I know, but I love watching women's cricket. That the Ashes series that just ended was as enthralling as the men's series. So you know, so why not put them on a level playing field?
Well, do you know now, Keith? Is there more that you would have you found a card or a bit?
I haven't, but I was just going to take Chris back to the very beginning, and this is from Wisden when you were a Cricketer of the Year, and a lady. I mean, I think John, you've mentioned about talent and also luck coming into things as well in life at the right time. And a lady called Benita White.
Oh, Benita, bless her.
Who I think was at the Chesterfield Cricket Society many years ago.
Chesterfield Cricket Lovers, I still remember an evening. Sadly, my parents had separated and eventually got divorced. And my brother and I were staying with my mum. And I remember my dad used to come over on a Friday to pick us up, take us to. And he came over one evening to pick us up. And he said, now, I've been speaking to your mum, and on a Friday evening down at Chesterfield Technical College, the Chesterfield Cricket Lovers run a cricket night for any young aspiring cricketer. Would you both like to go? And of course, we were both. So he said, Dad said, well, I'll pick you up and I'll take you down there, and then you'll come home with me for the weekend. And we were like, yes, we don't do that. So the following Friday, he came to pick us up, and I still remember he came in through the door, and he had these two cricket bats. One was a Gray Nichols, which my brother had, and one was a Gunnar Moore, which is what he gave me. And that was it. Off we went, and you were met at the door by this incredibly enthusiastic, I wouldn't call her preposterous, but incredibly enthusiastic lady called Benita White, who ran the whole program and put it together and brought in the volunteers, and she was there ever present every year of my life through to what I can remember, maybe 16 so from the age of 9 years old to 16, which doesn't sound, it's not a lot, 8 years, but back then it seemed like forever. Benita was a huge part of my life. And fast forward, I remember walking out to bat at Cape Town,
right,
playing for England, and as I walked down the steps, you're in the zone, aren't you? And as I walked down the steps, I heard this voice shouting to me from the left, Chris, like that. And I turned around, and it was Benita, and she was sat there, and she was like, come to watch you, you know, that sort of thing. And I still get that sort of spine tingling feeling that you know, somebody could impact your life quite so much in quite a positive way. You know, wonderful lady, and did so much for so many.
And that's probably a great encouragement for a lot of people out there who are just starting out and perhaps picking up a bat or a ball for the first time.
I'm not going to lie. Most of my coaching is, you get used to, when you play the game at a high level, you get used to coaching the game at a high level. You suddenly find yourself with a group of 8 or 9 year olds, and you can't coach them that way. You've got to coach them in a different way. And I still, she used to have this analogy of, you know, where your hands need to be in relationship to your body when you're batting. And she said, I want you to imagine that you're cuddling a teddy bear like that. And I said, I'm not imagining that. And she went, okay. Well, then you roll a towel up, and then you've got to hold the towel in between your hands and your tummy. And I said, that's a better analogy for me. Should we still laugh about that? But I still use that analogy with the younger ones to say, look, imagine you've got a rolled up towel and you're holding it in, but you're not squeezing it too tight into your tummy. It's just that's where your hands need to be. And it's little ditties like that, which, you know, I still refer to Benita, you know, point when you're teaching bowling, you know, you're, if you're a right arm bowler, your left arm points to the sky, your right arm points to the ground. It's simple little things which, you know, they don't teach you when you do your level four how to coach 8 year olds. They teach you how to coach, you know, 25 year olds. It's a real skill, and no less important.
Yeah, no, no. Well, my granddaughter's just come home from, she goes to preschool, and recently she came home. They have a different sport every week. And she came home and said to her parents, "I'm doing windmill arms."
That's
and
it.
This is the start of her bowling experience. So, and she's just four. So that's terrific.
That's brilliant.
Well, that's absolutely great. I mean, I don't know if the game, you talked about this game earlier where Matt Prior wanted to wanted a different declaration target. It wouldn't have been against Surrey, would it?
Could well have been.
Interestingly, it was a draw that game, but I'm just looking in the book here, and it says the final day was gloriously sunny, but the loss of a session had effectively cost Sussex a chance of setting a target that would ensure them against potentially damaging defeat and give them enough time to bowl Surrey out. It goes on and it says Ian Salisbury staged his own protest at Surrey's tactics by bowling seam up instead of spin. Salisbury that time playing for Surrey, of course. Those spectators not indulging in a slow hand clap headed for the beach. It was disappointing end to what had been an absorbing contest until the final two sessions. But Sussex had established themselves as serious rivals for Surrey's crown. So, and the match was drawn.
What year was that?
That was in the championship year. That was a match at Hove between the 30th of July and the 2nd of August.
It wasn't that game. The game I was talking about was early that. But that game was very important because that was the one time when I did insist that, and it, with the help of the dressing room actually, that we, what happened was there was a sea fret that came and the umpires took us off, or the umpires gave us the option of staying out there or coming off, and I took the option to go off. Got everyone in the changing room. In fact, we locked the door because I think the then chairman at the time, a chap called David Green, had got hold of Peter Moores and said, "The members are going ballistic, it's this uproar, you know, they were throwing away the championship, this is our, you know, we've got Surrey on the rack here, we, you know," and I think by memory we'd been in a really good position on two or three times during that game, and Surrey had just, as they were quality side, just dug in, got us through, so and got through those sticky periods, and we're still in there. They're a great team. So I remember asking the team to be honest, and they said, and I projected it as that we can't win the championship today, but we could lose it. If we lose this game to Surrey, and they win, they could go on and run away with it. Yeah. Whereas a draw keeps us in it for another game, and we keep one of our big rivals, you know, without that the points that they would get. So we locked the door and wouldn't let Peter in, bless him. I feel bad to this day, but, you know, it was, and that was the decision that was made. And you know, the rest, as they say, is history. Yes. So was it the right decision? I think so. We were to go on and play beautifully over the next two or three games. And Surrey actually went on and lost a couple of games after that. So there you go.
That's right. Yeah, that's terrific. Well, I think that probably brings us to the end of this chat with the multi-talented Chris Adams doing his various sports at Seaford College now, and the preposterously enthusiastic John Barclay. So thank you both for giving up your time today to come and help us with our podcasting experience. And maybe we can chat again about other matches in the future. So thanks very much for your help, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. We'll see you next year when we talk about something else. Let's make this a yearly thing.
Thanks a lot. It's been really good fun. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.